Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Adil Dodd, and to begin, he reviewed current available clinical research data on management of patients with melanoma and BRAF mutations.
There's a number of important things going on in the BRAF inhibitor field. We know that BRAF inhibitors by themselves can cause objective responses in a large proportion of patients with BRAF mutant melanoma. And if you add a MEK inhibitor to that, you can improve the response rates by another 20-30%, and you could increase the progression-free survival by a few more months. And so the BRAF-MEK inhibitor combination, I think, has become kind of like the de facto standard in treating patients with BRAF mutant melanoma, at least upfront. It's not 100% clear today whether you could salvage patients who have progressed on BRAF inhibitors by themselves by using the combo, but just upfront, BRAF-MEK seems to give you some benefit in terms of response rate and some benefit in terms of progression-free survival.
Now, when you talk about the combination in effect, are you talking about dabrafenib and trametinib?
Yeah, I think today we are talking about dabrafenib, trametinib, although I think in the next few months, there may be another BRAF-MEK combination. You know, we were part of the phase one clinical trial with cobimetinib and vemurafenib, and that looks equally good. And I think that could be a great option for people who, you know, may be worried about the fevers or may experience some problems with the dabrafenib-trametinib combination in their patients. Both cobimetinib and trametinib are really effective MEK inhibitors. I think the doses used are different, and cobimetinib is used on an intermittent schedule. It's 3-on, 1-off. But given some of these smaller distinctions, I think in terms of the side effect profile, in terms of ophthalmic toxicity and cardiac toxicity, I think they're relatively similar to each other. I think dabrafenib and vemurafenib are quite different from each other, and the spectrum of toxicity is very different for each of these agents. But the MEK addition seems to be, I think in both cases, seems to reduce the incidence of squamous cell carcinomas, which is something to be concerned about in patients, especially if you're treating them for months at a time. And if you live in Florida or California or one of these places where, you know, there's a fair incidence of sun damage, you're reducing that. But on the other hand, you have to worry now about some of the cardiac issues, ophthalmic toxicity, which is unique to the MEK inhibitors. We don't see a lot of MEK specific toxicity like the acneiform rashes and diarrhea when you use this combination. I think it's part of this interesting mechanism where the BRAF inhibitor seems to cancel some of the MEK inhibitor toxicity and vice versa. The MEK inhibitor seems to cancel some of the BRAF, unique BRAF inhibitor toxicity. So in a sense, it's a good combination because, you know, not that you don't get additive toxicity, but in many instances, you seem to cancel unique toxicity profiles of that other agent out. So I don't personally think that toxicity will be a problem either with the dabrafenib-trametinib combo or with the cobimetinib-vemurafenib combo from my personal experience anyway.
Can you go through specifically what you mentioned, ophthalmic issues and cardiac issues? Can you go through exactly what things have been reported, both with the individual agents as well as the combinations, and what the incidence of these problems are?
So if you go back to like maybe 10 years, Pfizer was developing this agent called CI-1040. And I think at that time, some serious ophthalmic issues were reported with this MEK inhibitor. And these included things like central serous retinopathy and occasionally retinal vein occlusion and thrombosis. And I believe that this drug was actually discontinued because of these serious ophthalmic toxicities, even though it appeared to be an effective drug. Subsequently, I think the second and third generation MEK inhibitors have been re-engineered to some extent to reduce their CNS penetration and their ophthalmic toxicity profiles. So what we are seeing now is not the more serious, irreversible toxicities that were seen with the older generation MEK inhibitors, but more central serous retinopathy, which is another way of saying that the retinal fluid accumulates and the retina separates a little bit from the pigment epithelium. And so that can cause blurring or blurred vision. And to a large extent, this is a reversible toxicity, but it does need baseline ophthalmic exams and it does need sensitivity on the part of the treating oncologist. If a patient complains of blurred vision, you might consider sending that patient to the ophthalmologist and getting something called an OCT, which is a kind of a CAT scan of the eye to make sure that your patient maybe is not developing this kind of fluid formation. in the retina. And if that happens, stop the agent. And in most cases, the retinal toxicity will resolve.
Have you actually seen it yourself? And have you seen it ophthalmologically on physical exam?
No, I haven't. And we've actually taken part in both the dabrafenib trametinib phase 1 trial, and I've treated many patients with dabrafenib trametinib. We've also taken part in the cobimetinib vemurafenib trial and also treated many patients, you know, with both of these combinations. I personally haven't seen that. I've had lots of patients complain of blurred vision, send them to the ophthalmologist, and it's turned out to be more age-related changes in the lens or something like that. I can't say that I've personally seen a case. In the dabrafenib trametinib phase 1 trial, which was reported in the New England Journal, I believe there was one case that was part of that publication.
You mentioned also cardiac issues.
Yeah, the cardiac issues are relatively common, and I have experienced this at firsthand. Usually, there's an asymptomatic reduction in ejection fraction. And if you start off at 65%, and if somebody's ejection fraction drops to 55%, even if it's still within normal limits, that would be a reason to reduce the dose of the MEK inhibitor or stop the MEK inhibitor. In addition, you can sometimes see hypertension also, but to me, the more worrisome side effect is the reduced ejection fraction, and it appears to be a class-wide toxicity of the MEK inhibitors. And in our practice, we do routine echocardiograms at baseline and every 3 months. I think not everybody does that, and we'll have to see how the FDA's position in terms of requiring this evolves over time. But that's another MEK-specific toxicity to be cognizant of.
Globally, what's your take on the incidence of cardiac issues, specifically drops in ejection fraction?
It's low, but it's in a few percentage range. So it's not unknown, but it's low. And in the scheme of melanoma, metastatic melanoma anyhow, it may not be a super significant side effect, but I think it's something to be aware of. I think in the adjuvant setting, I think it may be more of a concern. If these agents do move into the adjuvant setting, I think you might have to have a much more stringent approach to monitoring toxicity.
What exactly is the difference in the mechanism of action of COBI versus trametinib?
They're both pretty specific allosteric MEK inhibitors. So I don't think you have a true difference in the mechanism. I think they're different molecular entities that fit into MEK differently. Trametinib is extraordinarily potent. COBI is less potent, but you know, in human beings, how that translates, you know, COBI is given at a much higher dose compared to trametinib. It's 60 versus 2, and COBI is given 3 on, 1 off versus continuously. So I think neither one of them in this situation is really at its MTD. You could probably go higher with either one of those agents, you know, at least short term, beyond the FDA-approved doses. But I think they're just different molecular entities.
So I'm going to ask you, if you had 4 patients coming into your clinic, one of them was going to be starting on dabrafenib. One of them was going to be started on dabrafenib and trametinib. Another one was going to be started on vemurafenib. And a fourth one was going to be started on vemurafenib and COBI. What would you say to each one of those 4 patients before they started that therapy in terms of what to expect or what to look for in terms of side effects?
For the dabrafenib patient, I'd say that the major side effects would be the squamous cell carcinoma, fevers, and fatigue. For the vemurafenib alone patient, I talk about joint pains, photosensitivity reactions, and secondary squamous cell carcinoma. For the DAB and TRAM patients, I talk to them about fevers because that is by far the most worrisome common side effect. And we actually have a paper that's currently in submission stages talking about the characteristics of fever. And I tell people that 60% of patients will have fever within the first 3 to 5 weeks. Of those 60%, about half will have another episode of fever within the next month, and about 15% will have 3 or more episodes of fever. A lot of times you could just stop the drug when you have a fever and then just restart it back once you're afebrile at the same exact doses before, no dose reduction. Take some Tylenol or Motrin during, you know, just symptomatically. And surprisingly, you kind of just grow out of the fever if you just resume taking the drug at the same dose as before.
What do the patients tell you? You know, when does this come on? How high does the fever go? Do they get chills? What do you actually see?
A lot of people say that there's this kind of prodromal, you know, hot flash, chill for a day or two. And then they'll start feeling like they've got a fever. They'll take their temperature. It's oftentimes quite high, especially for younger patients. It could be 101, 102, even 103. And they don't necessarily feel terrible, but the temperature, you know, if you put a thermometer in, you kind of notice that your temperature is pretty high. And if you keep taking the drugs, you'll continue to have fevers oftentimes for a week or more. And so it's important in this case to just stop taking the drugs, to interrupt treatment right away. As soon as you notice a fever, even if it's at night, don't take the next morning's dose. And usually within a day or two, that fever will resolve. And all you have to do is to drink plenty of fluid, symptomatic stuff. In the past, you know, a few years ago, we would send patients into the hospital and check their white counts, admit them, give them antibiotics, fever workup, blood cultures, and nothing turns up usually in those situations. I think as oncologists, we are so used to, you know, fever, neutropenia, danger, antibiotics, admit to the hospital, you know, of that whole spectrum. So it's actually hard for us to get used to the fact that, you know, somebody could be having fevers at home and you don't necessarily need to check them out for infection or work them up, get chest x-rays, etc. So I think that's the fear factor that we in oncology have. But it's pretty rare for people to have infectious complications. But I think that's something to think about. You know, could this person be having a pneumonia or a urinary tract infection? And that's just masquerading as a dabrafenib trimetinib fever. But what's, you know, very characteristic thing is that the fever often happens between 3 weeks to 5 weeks of starting treatment. And it's very stereotyped. It kind of crescendos in a day or so, goes away when you stop taking the drug, and then oftentimes won't recur right away, but will recur in 3 to 4 weeks. We are not 100% sure why it's so periodic, except that, you know, some metabolite of dabrafenib seems to be causing it, and it seems to take some time to accumulate in the blood and also take some time to be metabolized out of blood. And somehow this fever syndrome is aggravated by the MEK inhibitor, even though there's no direct PK interaction between trimetinib and whatever metabolite it is of dabrafenib that's causing this. But that's my hypothesis, that it's some kind of interaction between trimetinib and dabrafenib that's causing, you know, 60% fevers instead of 30% fevers, which is what you see with dabrafenib alone.
And just sort of globally in terms of quality of life, you know, on these, again, four different options, sort of taking a macro look back in terms of the hassles, the side effects, change in doses, you know, whatever, globally, maybe almost even on a 1 to 10 kind of thing, how much of a hassle is it for a patient to take any one of these four routes?
I think most of them are pretty tolerable. Vemurafenib by itself, usually the first couple of months are the most difficult, when, you know, you kind of have to figure out how to get the sunscreen on, and you kind of have to figure out how much you can be out in the sun without getting a severe sunburn. You know, maybe have a hat on when you're golfing and long sleeve shirts and stuff like that, or when you're washing your car. I think some people are extremely photosensitive with vemurafenib. Over months, the joint aches, joint pain seem to be the big complaint. With dabrafenib, trimetinib, or dabrafenib alone, I think it's the fevers. And once you get the hang of how to manage the fevers, I personally think it's pretty easy to deal with them. With Vem and Kobe, we've had some patients who have now been on for 3 years. Again, and this may not be reflected in the publications, like in the Lancet Oncology publication, but my personal impression from talking to patients is that patients actually will tell you that on the week that they're off Kobe, that's actually the week when a lot of the side effects seem to be the worst. And the 3 weeks that they're on Kobe and Vem together, they seem to tolerate better. But when you look at the AEs by grade, you can actually look at them and think, oh my God, that's a lot of AEs by grade. But I think some of it is also because, you know, patients are on for a really long time, and each time somebody has fatigue or each time somebody has nausea, that's recorded. So it may be not as significant as the AEs indicate. And certainly if you look back to what's the ancient prehistory of melanoma, you know, treating patients with interferon or interleukin-2, I mean, certainly compared to that, you're not talking anything comparable to what we've seen before.
So here's a simple one. How do you go about deciding whether to start upfront systemic therapy with a BRAF inhibitor or the combination as opposed to immunotherapy?
I think there are patients, there are distinct subsets of patients, you know, that benefit from it, I personally think. And I think if you have somebody who has very extensive disease, liver mets, bone mets, significant volume of disease, maybe symptomatic, I think almost always in that case, you should start with a BRAF MEK combo or a BRAF inhibitor, if that's the way you want to go. If you have somebody who has pulmonary met, lower volume disease, today I think it might make sense to start off with immunotherapy, especially if you have the option of putting a patient on a highly effective immunotherapy like an anti-PD-1 drug. You might consider doing that. We are waiting to see how the combo with PD-1 and BRAF, MEK, or one of these different permutations and combinations holds up. But I personally favor using the PD-1 antibodies upfront in patients even with BRAF mutant disease, thinking that, you know, longer term, that offers them a better possibility of cure.
You mentioned the concept of combining a BRAF inhibitor, BRAF MEK, with immunotherapy. What are some of the combinations out there? What's the rationale for doing that?
I think on a simple level, the rationale is basically combining two effective approaches to treatment, one which results in rapid regression but limited long-term control, with another approach to therapy that has the exact opposite, relatively low shrinkage, maybe 30-40%, but a very long tail to that curve, and just combining. So that's the clinical angle. On the immunologic angle, there's data from Jennifer Wargo and from others that just simple treatment with BRAF inhibitor in the short term causes infiltration with CD8 T cells, and maybe those CD8 T cells could be exploited. They seem to be a good surrogate for the type of, you know, the anti-PD-1 target cell, which we think is a CD8 PD-1 expressing cytotoxic T cell. So you might, with that antigen shedding, immunogenic kind of conversion of a tumor with short-term BRAF inhibitor, you might actually get higher response rates with your PD-1 drug. So that's one rationale that's maybe more immunologic.
And in terms of non-protocol management, just to sort of put anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 to the side, what sequence of immunotherapy or what would you start out with in terms of immunotherapy nowadays, again, outside a trial setting?
I think for the most part, people have switched to using, and I've switched to using ipilimumab as an initial immunotherapy, which is, ipilimumab is actually a reasonable drug to use. I think the limitations of ipilimumab are just the severe unpredictable toxicity, which is the colitis and diarrhea, which, depending on which population you're treating, could be a really serious problem. There's other problems with ipilimumab, such as, you know, hypophysitis and skin rashes and liver function test abnormality. But I think the diarrhea and colitis is what concerns me the most. Sometimes you need people to be on steroids for months to safely resolve the colitis and get them off the colitis. And in the meantime, steroid side effects can add up, and you're talking a fairly serious amount of toxicity for a drug that ultimately has a 10% response rate. Although stable diseases from ipilimumab can also be pretty high quality. And, you know, if you look at some of the data that's been presented by Jed Wolchok and by other investigators showing really long tail to that ipi survival curve, and with an inflection point around 2 to 3 years, and then subsequently showing lasting, durable, even stable disease, which is something we don't see a lot with other types of therapies. So I think ipi, for the most part, in my practice, has become like the go-to immunotherapy outside of PD-1.
And what about high-dose interleukin-2? Are there any situations now that you're using it or recommending it?
I think high-dose interleukin-2 for your young, healthy patient, pulmonary mets, you might consider doing that, especially if somebody has a history of bowel disease where you might not want to use ipi. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But I think just for me personally, doing a couple of interleukin-2s a year doesn't make sense because, you know, it has this learning curve issue. You want to make sure that you're on the same page with your nursing team and with your ICU attendings in terms of when to dose and when not to dose, when to hold. So I feel like if you're doing less than 10 or 15 a year, you might not be as proficient with doing it and make sense for you to just refer to others. In our case, we have made the decision to refer patients to other centers where they might be doing it more, where they're more proficient with high-dose IL-2.
Can you talk about the types of BRAF mutations that are seen with melanoma? I know there's a V600E, V600K. What do we know about the different types of mutations and their responsiveness to BRAF inhibitors?
I think if you look at the 600 mutations, most of them are pretty responsive to BRAF inhibitors. The most responsive, of course, is the E's, But Ds, Ks are also somewhat responsive, maybe 10 to 20% less responsive than the Es. And I think people have made the case that, you know, you should use BRAF and MEK inhibitor combination therapy for the non-E mutation. Again, because the MEK inhibitor seems to target those non-Es better. I mean, I think you could make the same case for the Es also. All of them are more responsive to the combination versus a single agent.
What do we know about the mechanisms of resistance that occur with BRAF inhibitors?
There's 4 or 5 different mechanisms that have been proposed, which is another way of saying we don't really know the answer. I think one mechanism that's been proposed is this escape or bypass, and that, you know, different enzymes have been proposed that can bypass MEK and basically lead to ERK activation downstream of MEK. And so there's a couple of different enzymes that have been proposed for that. Other mechanisms that have been proposed is activation of the IGF-1 pathway. One other mechanism that's been proposed by Roger Low and his colleagues at UCLA has been this kind of sleeper activation mechanism where these V600E mutant cells kind of go into this hibernation and then gradually develop more activation downstream at the level of ERK through adaptive, you know, activation of other enzymes. It seems like you can't, like the melanoma cell, can't really get beyond the MAP kinase pathway, but just blocking it at 2 levels may not be sufficient. You know, you could get activation of ERK or you could get activation of CDK4/6. And there's a lot of interesting clinical trials out there looking at blocking CDK4/6 along with BRAF or along with BRAF-MEK, which I think could result in even more advances in PFS.
Any comments on management of brain mets with BRAF-positive melanoma?
I think the one area that I see a lot of confusion about is the treatment of brain mets in BRAF-mutant melanoma. That's a frequent problem. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there is data with dabrafenib alone with 40% response rates in brain mets, in melanoma brain mets, and that's been published already. I think vemurafenib may also have some activity in brain mets, but I think it's something to consider. If your patient has progression of disease in the brain, you might consider using dabrafenib or dabrafenib-trametinib, just depending on how comfortable you are with the combination. And I think you can get some control of brain mets with these agents, probably similar to what you get with whole brain radiation therapy.
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing this with a number of targeted therapies, particularly I hear a lot about this in non-small cell lung cancer with EGFR, TKIs, and ALK, the question of the patient who is asymptomatic from brain mets, and the question of whether you can use targeted therapy without radiation therapy, at least initially. So is that something you do?
Yeah, and you know, I'm increasingly aware of the CNS damage that's caused by whole brain radiation therapy, especially the cognitive problems that are caused by it. And I personally prefer using targeted agents and stereotactic radiation rather than whole brain radiation, which has not been super effective in melanoma, you know, because melanoma is resistant to radiation. So you really have to get to higher doses. If you use the higher doses, you'll get more cognitive decline. And I think I personally prefer to hold off on whole brain radiation therapy until it's absolutely clear that it's needed and no amount of stereotactic or targeted agents will cure you.
Another sort of general concept that comes up with targeted therapy is this question of, I don't know, the escaping clone or something where you have the disease under control, but there's one area, of course, the brain you just mentioned, but maybe some systemic area that's growing. And the question of using some type of local treatment, surgery, radiation, or whatever. How often does that occur with melanoma?
It does happen a lot, and it's an intriguing, and yeah, we're very aware of that, that, you know, you could be treating people, and let's say the liver responds, but the spleen doesn't respond, or liver responds, but the lungs don't respond, or lung responds, and the inguinal lymph nodes start growing. So I think in that case, you might consider surgery or radiation to that non-responsive area. Although I would argue that if you're really looking longer term, maybe that's an occasion for you to switch to immunotherapy.
So I want to ask you about these agents in the adjuvant setting in terms of what trials are ongoing, what we know about them. What trials are looking at BRAF inhibitors or the combination in the adjuvant setting? What trials are looking at immunotherapy? What kind of immunotherapy? And I saw at ASCO, there was the report of a phase 3 adjuvant trial of IPI. I'd like to know also what you thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of interest in moving these agents into the adjuvant setting. the BRAF-MEK inhibitor combo, dabrafenib-trametinib, is being tested in the adjuvant setting versus placebo. And Genentech is testing VEM and COBI versus, again, placebo, not interferon. And the EORTC has looked at ipilimumab, and that trial was reported at ASCO and actually looked really interesting in terms of its efficacy. I think the one concern with that trial was that it used a pretty high dose of ipi, and it also used high dose maintenance. And so there was a fair amount of adverse events, and a relatively small proportion of patients on ipi actually completed their treatment. I think what we don't know about that trial is the overall survival. I think that's ultimately what will have to be positive. That's what's missing with the interferon data. You know, we know interferon reduces recurrence risk. What we don't know about interferon is, does it really prolong survival? And I think if ipi is proven to prolong survival, I think that could be a reasonable option. I think PD-1, there's a proposal at SWOG to look at PD-1 versus interferon. And I think that's a really great trial to put your patients on. I mean, I would strongly favor that trial. I think the one issue with the PD-1 drugs is, do you actually need tumor to trigger off your PD-1 expressing CD8 T cell to proliferate? If you don't have tumor, is it going to proliferate? Is it going to set up a de novo adaptive immune response? I think it could be that PD-1 agents might work better in the neoadjuvant setting, where you maybe treat them before you have surgery, treat patients before you have surgery, then, you know, remove the tumor. And then that might be a rational thing to consider also.
Let's finish out talking about your cases. We can start out with your 29-year-old woman with BRAF V600E mutant metastatic melanoma. What was her prior history?
Her prior history was she developed a back melanoma in her early 20s, and she had a sentinel lymph node biopsy done. It was negative. She didn't receive any adjuvant therapy. She was doing fine until she noticed, actually, interesting, she noticed a lump on her chest wall and, you know, was worked up for breast cancer initially because, you know, that's what's commonly done. It was biopsied, found to be melanoma. She then noticed other lumps over her body. Those were consistent with melanoma. PET scan was done. They were super hot on PET scan, which, you know, a lot of melanomas are super hot on PET scan. And the mutation analysis was done. She was found to have V600E mutation. And at that point, we saw her.
And she also had brain mets?
Initially, not. She had BRAF MEK inhibitor therapy. And then she had a dramatic early response to it. And a few months later, she developed brain metastases.
Just to go back to that original decision, though. So when she presented, she had sub-Q lesions, she had lymph nodes and lung mets. Why did you decide to treat her with a BRAF inhibitor with a MEK inhibitor as opposed to an immunotherapy?
In her case, her disease volume was pretty significant, and she was having rapid, you know, she would notice new mets almost every week. So even though in many ways this could be a good patient for immunotherapy, at the time I thought maybe shrinking the total volume, you know, creating a runway for immunotherapy would be a reasonable thing to do, and that's where I was coming from.
So as you started her therapy and she started to respond, what kinds of side effects, if any, did she encounter?
I think she had a very significant fever episode, but like we do with our patients with dabrafenib trametinib, we asked her to just hold, restart back. I think her other symptoms were some nausea, some anorexia, fatigue, but, you know, she continued to do well. She was able to work. She was able to go hiking and camping and stuff, you know, really continue her life pretty much as normal until this point where we got a routine MRI scan on her, and she had been asymptomatic at that time, but lo and behold, the MRI scan showed two new brain mets.
Now, her systemic disease was in a CR?
Was at least a very significant PR. I think she had some just barely palpable masses. On the PET scan, they were not FDG avid, and they were very much shrunken down compared to before.
So she gets started on Gamma Knife treatment.
Yeah.
And did you keep the BRAF inhibitor and the MEK inhibitor going, incidentally?
When she had the brain met develop, we actually had a conversation about switching to immune therapy at some point, and I think that had been our plan all along, but that kind of brought it right up to the fore. So when she finished the Gamma Knife, I kept her on the BRAF and MEK inhibitor therapy, but at that point, I'd referred her to the NIH for consideration of TIL therapy, and we actually took her off the BRAF and MEK inhibitor because her systemic disease was in such, you know, great control that actually there was nothing to harvest there. So we actually took her off it so that, you know, there would be something to harvest, send her to the NIH. I think they actually sampled one of her tumors and didn't find a lot of TILs in them. And so she came back to see us. At that point, we started evaluating her for PD-1, and it just happened to be a point where, you know, our PD-1 trials didn't have slots on them. And so we actually put her on IPI, and then she's just starting PD-1 now.
So just to backtrack a little bit, could you talk a little bit about what TIL therapy is and whether or not it's been useful at all in melanoma?
So, you know, Steve Rosenberg and his colleagues at the NIH and Patrick Hu and Jeff Weber and Tony Ribas have been exploring this type of therapy for many, many years now. Basically, the idea is that you harvest a tumor, you have your CD8 T cells and CD4 T, you know, you have tumor infiltrating lymphocytes. You basically extract them from the tumor, grow them ex vivo, cause them to proliferate ex vivo, prepare the patient by doing a kind of a mini bone marrow transplant, and reinfuse those cells back in after you've created some space in their marrow, give patients interleukin-2, which is a cytokine for these. So it's a pretty extensive, pretty, you know, market type of therapy. And at the end of that, if it's successful, you can have remarkable shrinkage of tumor and long-term remission, which is, you know, she would be a perfect candidate for being such a young and healthy person.
So she actually, they were not able to actually grow the TILs.
They were not able to grow the TILs. So even though these tumors proliferated great in vivo, I guess there weren't enough TILs in them, or the TILs weren't able to proliferate enough ex vivo.
So she comes back to you, you start on IPI, what happened then?
We started on IPI. She actually did good with IPI and didn't notice tumor shrinkage, but, you know, was symptomatically pretty stable. And we're just starting her on PD-1. And I think from the first few weeks of her being on PD-1, I can see a nice shrinkage of tumor. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I think we haven't had enough time to repeat her scans to see how effective the PD-1 will be. And I'm also worried about her brain met status just to make sure that that's okay.
Which agent is she receiving?
We put her on the expanded access program with the MK34, you know, also known as pembrolizumab.
Any side effects or toxicity either from the IPI or the PD-1?
Not really. Not really. So far it's been a pretty benign course, both with IPI and with the PD-1 drug.
What would you do if she had progressive disease?
I think we would consider either putting her on, you know, an experimental clinical trial. Maybe we have a clinical trial with the BRAF and MEK inhibitor along with CDK4/6 inhibitor. Maybe that would be a reasonable choice. We're also looking at a combination of PD-L1 plus BRAF and MEK, and that might be a reasonable thing to do. I think you're talking different permutations and combinations.
What do we know about anti-PD-1 or IPI, for that matter, as it relates to brain mets?
IPI does have some ability to control brain mets, and that's been published already by Kim Margolin and her colleagues in Lancet. In terms of PD-1, we don't have hard evidence that somebody's had tumor shrinkage, to my knowledge. But what we've noticed in our pembrolizumab trial, and what other people have noticed with nivolumab, is that even though patients need to be, quote-unquote, brain met controlled, some of these patients have been on for a very long time without developing new brain mets. And almost by extrapolation, you've got to be somewhat effective in terms of controlling your brain met for you to have, you know, years on treatment without having progression of your brain mets.
Why don't we talk about your second patient, the 49-year-old with the rectal melanoma?
So this 49-year-old with the rectal melanoma was treated with biochemotherapy, progression of disease, referred for clinical trials. So even though in many ways she's not the kind of patient who responds great to immunotherapy, I put her on there because she was put on the PD-1 drug and actually has had a near complete response. And it's been 2 years now, and she's, you know, just doing extremely well. You know, just to illustrate the point that even though biochemotherapy has some immune agents in it, interleukin-2 and interferon, and she progressed on biochemotherapy, she's still, just to illustrate the point that immunotherapy, unlike, say, targeted therapy, it's not necessarily, there's enough differences between IPI and PD-1, and certainly between interleukin-2 and PD-1, and between all these agents, and there is enough that we don't understand about them that you can't assume that if somebody didn't respond to PD-1, they won't respond to IPI, and certainly vice versa, we know that isn't the case.
What do we know about the site of primary? This lady had a rectal melanoma, but site of primary and response to immunotherapy and, for that matter, BRAF inhibitors?
I think that's a great question. Now, she actually, even though rectal primaries are not known to be BRAF mutant in general, her melanoma actually was BRAF mutant. She has a V600E mutant melanoma. And her history is very interesting. She actually had a second primary on her arm, which was V600E mutant. And then she had this other primary in the rectal mucosa that was also V600E mutant. So I think, you know, showing that you can't automatically assume that a primary, especially in the rectal anal area, which is, you know, the skin, there's mucosa, you can't always assume that those will be BRAF wild type, even though statistically you'd be right in thinking that it's infrequent for those to be. I think people look for c-KIT and NRAS mutant melanomas in that setting, but not BRAF mutant melanomas. But again, I think even with a V600E mutant melanoma, you can certainly have very profound responses to PD-1.
Did she have any toxicity?
She's had some fatigue, but she's really able to. She's gone back to college. She used to work at Starbucks. She's subsequently resumed her education and really is, you know, aside from the fact that she needs to come every 2 weeks to get her PD-1, she's on a 2-week cycle. She's really doing extremely well with the treatment.
Let's finish out with your 65-year-old patient with a BRAF V600E melanoma.
So this is a patient who's had a very difficult, but I think increasingly common course of treatment. You know, about in 2010, he was put on a vemurafenib clinical trial. He progressed on that, was changed to a vemurafenib plus cobimetinib trial, progressed on that as well, started on PD-1, progressed on that as well, and then ultimately had involvement of the pericardium. And we tried to get him on a different clinical trial, but unfortunately, he died before he could really, in the time that I sent you these cases, and just recently, that's what I found out. I brought him in because, you know, even though he's had a finite time on these treatments, really, from the time that he had metastatic melanoma, it's 4 years now. And I think I just brought him on because I think that may be the future of melanoma treatment where, you know, from 8 months, we've gone to 11 months. And now a lot of trials are looking, showing 2 years of overall survival. And I think soon we'll be going to 3 and 4, you know, or I'm hoping we'll go to 3 and 4 years if once these patients are managed optimally and you're kind of surfing from therapy to therapy, you know, without compromising patient's performance status.
But just to be clear, when he got the vemurafenib or the vemurafenib with the BRAF, he got it with Kobe? Was that it? And then the other immunotherapies, did he respond?
Yeah, he had profound response. He had a response lasting a couple of years, first with the BRAF inhibitor, and then about a couple of years with the BRAF and with the Vem and Kobe. And about a year with PD-1. So he's had nice responses to each one of those, but ultimately progressed. And, you know, we have a nice record in, because he had a lot of biopsiable tumors. So we know he developed escape with ERK activation with the VEM, again, with the combination. And then he developed, you know, initially had more CD8 T cells. And then ultimately those exhausted T cells, I guess, stopped coming